When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
This is Laura Brown, sitting in for Richard McCall on Columbia Calling with episode 176. Today we're going to be talking to Janelle Gray, who's telling us about her recent book, Echoes of the Struggle. We're sitting at Quechua Cafe in the Zona G in Bogota. Hi Janelle, how are you?
I'm well, how are you?
Good, thanks. Thanks for joining us on Columbia Calling today.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us, how did you end up in Columbia?
I always love telling people that story. It's really simple. I closed my eyes and picked a country.
Wow.
It's really that simple.
Yeah. So you had never had like an inclination to move to Columbia before? No.
Not at all.
No.
I chose South America just because I wanted to be able to utilize my Spanish. I'd studied Spanish and I'd already been to Spain, which was my original first choice.
Okay.
So it really, in terms of Colombia, it was almost like just looking at a map and just...
And where are you from again? You're from Texas.
I'm from Texas, Dallas.
Okay, from Dallas, Texas. Mm-hmm. Okay, nice. And how long have you been living in Colombia?
2 years.
2 years.
Two years as of last week.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. And always in Bogota or have you lived anywhere
always
else?
In Bogota.
Okay, great. Yeah. And have you traveled a bit around Colombia?
No.
You haven't?
I really need to get my life together.
Yeah, there's so many places
Other places to see. Yeah, I haven't really done a lot of traveling. A little bit, but not much.
Yeah. And how was the transition? How did you find moving over here?
It was a little rough. It was a little rough because I don't think I'm a super outgoing person.
Okay.
I think I'm a big homebody.
Okay.
So I find myself more comfortable being at home and I had my own friends. So the idea of moving to another country where I didn't know anybody.
You didn't know anybody here?
I had never been to Colombia. I didn't know anybody here. Okay. I didn't have a job here.
Yeah.
So it was a little rough. But it was more because of me and my personality. It had nothing to do with the country or with, I think, even moving out of the country. It was just me and my personality.
And did you come here specifically to write the book? Were you looking for a space where you could focus on your writing?
Yes.
That was already a thing that you had?
Yeah. I think the easiest way that I describe it is I when I decided to quit corporate.
What were you doing in corporate?
I worked for a rental car company for seven years, and I worked out in the field, like in the sales area, and then I also worked in the accounting department.
Okay.
So when I decided to quit, it was just I wasn't happy.
Okay.
I've always been a writer, I guess.
Right.
It's so weird to actually say that. But I've always been a writer. I've always enjoyed writing.
Okay.
And so the idea to leave corporate was about being able to find, my best life, whatever that was.
Yeah.
Whatever that was. And that
to have the time to explore your creative side.
Yeah.
It was
more about finding, and so my thought was, I'm going to go to Columbia.
Okay.
I am going to experience life as a writer.
Right.
And it'll be probably 6 to 8 months. That's how much money I have.
Okay. Okay. So you came here with the idea of just writing. You weren't, looking for a job.
Yeah. No, I knew I was probably going to need to look for a job.
Right.
That eating thing is a thing.
Okay. Yeah. Rent, things
right.
like that.
Right. Little things. I had enough money without work to stay for 6 to 8 months.
Okay.
But I knew that I was probably going to look for another job.
Yeah.
And I had prepared to teach English. Like, I had taken all the certifications.
Ah, okay. Oh, great. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so what sort of research did you do ahead of moving to Colombia? Did you find out, or did you just arrive completely blind? Like, okay, let's just see what's out there.
I did a little bit of research, but not a lot. Usually what, you know, what you hear in the U.S. is not positive.
Right.
So the idea of really doing a lot of research, I really wasn't particularly going to know about that. Like, I didn't, I didn't want to be dissuaded.
Okay, right. I get that.
So, but I did a little bit. A lot of the things that I did, you know, I was on, like, Facebook. Like, I found certain groups and I talked to people.
Okay.
And
living here? Or
people who had recently been here, who had lived here for a little bit. There are, you know, Facebook groups like Black Americans Living Abroad that whole thing. So I would find myself in certain groups looking for people who have lived here at some point.
Okay.
But that was pretty much...
Okay.
I'd rather hear it from them than read all the statistics about...
That's right, yeah. Because Colombia, like, some years ago, didn't have a very good reputation.
Yeah.
Yeah, which, I mean, obviously, as we can see, has changed a lot.
It has changed. It is not what it looks like on TV.
No, it's not. It doesn't fit the stereotype that a lot of people have.
No.
What did your family say? What did your parents say when you said that you were moving to Colombia?
Depends on what parent you're talking about.
Okay.
So, my mom... My stepfather wasn't... He's always supportive, period, point blank. He's just going to be... Now, he might not like it, but he's never going to say no. My mom was a little concerned. So, at first, actually, I considered changing and going to Chile.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I had said I was coming to Colombia. Apparently, that gave her a little bit of time to look up some things. And she was not on board with that. So, I had changed to Chile. And then... I think maybe the last 3 months.
Okay.
Maybe a little bit more. I was like, you know what? No. My first mind was to go to Colombia. Yeah. I'm going to go to Colombia.
Okay.
And so, my daddy, my biological father, my daddy, daddy just said, great, now I have somewhere to go. Like, daddy didn't hesitate. He was just like, yeah, go.
Sure, go.
So it was kind of like all across the board. There was the quiet, I don't really want you to go. There was the loud, I don't want you to go. And there was like, go, be free.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, I think my experience was probably similar to your dad.
Mm-hmm.
Because my dad reads a lot. He does a lot of research and... he's always been interested in Colombia, and like for many years he's said to me, you know, Colombia is a really up and coming country, and he's been suggesting for like probably about 5 years or maybe more that I should come to Colombia because he knew that I had this love for South America, or for Latin America rather.
Okay.
And I've been to various other places in Latin America, but I had never actually been to Colombia before 2.5 years ago when I actually decided to move here. And yeah, so he wasn't surprised at all. He was like very happy when I said that I was coming here.
Almost like he was waiting.
Yeah,
he was waiting for it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think he probably knows even maybe more than I do about Colombia. Like, he can tell you who the mayor is. Like, he can tell me who the mayor was 10 years ago and like what he achieved and how he had, you know, what the government had been doing to combat crime and to in terms of development and all this kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's not my strong suit. That would be something that my daddy would do.
Yeah.
But my daddy has really, really good, I think, foresight about a lot of things. Like, he's the reason I learned Spanish.
Ah, okay.
When we were younger, he was like, you need to learn Spanish. Well, living in Texas, but he was like, you need to learn Spanish. You're going to need to know.
Yeah.
You know, and he said by the time you're an adult and you're working, Spanish is going to be a big deal. It's going to give you an edge.
Right, exactly.
And he told us that when we were like 9.
Wow. Okay.
Before it was a big deal.
You learned Spanish a long time before coming here.
Yeah, I did. I studied it in high school. Okay. And then my second degree is in Spanish. In Spanish literature.
Oh, okay. Wow. Nice.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
But I don't... it's not the same as speaking.
Yeah.
It's not the same as actually putting it into action when I got here. But I had a foundation.
Yeah. And have you had many friends or family come to visit you out here?
Yes.
You have? Okay, that's
yes.
Great. That's nice.
Yeah, my mom's been here. I have many, many siblings.
Mm-hmm.
And 3 of them have been. Two
oh, that's great.
Are
that's
scheduled
nice.
To come in May after they graduate.
Yeah.
my daddy and my other sister want to come. So, I've had some visitors.
Okay. Oh, that's great. So people are seeing it for themselves.
Yes. Mom was the first one. Okay. And I think once she took that message back to people, like, people began to chill out a little bit. But when she came in November and she was like, okay. She has a group of friends.
Yeah.
She's in a safe area. Oh, like, good. So that's I think she just had to be the messenger to go back and tell everybody to chill out.
No, it's true. I still get a lot of friends and, like, not so much family members, but a lot of friends saying to me, like, Colombia, you live in Colombia. It's so dangerous.
Yeah.
And then I send them pictures and they're like, oh, wow.
Right. Like, we're
not what I expected.
We're just outside, you know, having lunch in a park, exactly. chilling. Yeah. Like, nobody's bothering us.
Exactly.
It's not what you think.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Wow. And so tell us about your book, Echoes of the Struggle. Is it your first book?
It is my first novel.
It's your first
novel. I released a book of poetry right before I came here. So 2 years ago, I released a book of poetry. Yeah. And that book was more, it was different from this one. It was something that I had been writing for decades. Like, the first thing is the entry that I made when I was, 11.
Oh,
and so it goes from age 11 to 27.
Wow.
And so that one's different. This is my first novel. So this is a different kind of baby.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a different kind of baby. But.
And how did you, like, where did the idea come from? How did you bring it all together?
The idea came from, speaking of daddies and how they are searchers of knowledge. My father was in a master's program at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. And he had gone to... he had gone on a civil rights pilgrimage, and I had seen some of the pictures that he had gone on, and I was like, God, I really wish I could do that. And so the next year, he was able to convince, I don't know what he did, he brought them coffee or something, I don't know, and convinced them, even though I'm not a student, I'm not an alum, never been to SMU, they allowed me to go. And so it was very life-changing, obviously, right?
And so that's pretty much what the book is about. The book is about the civil rights movement in the U.S.
Correct.
Okay, so it tells the story of, it's kind of narrated through the eyes of Daniela.
Yes.
Who relates the civil rights movement and what she's learned about what happened in history and relates it to the modern day life in the U.S.
Yes, that's correct. Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you went on this civil rights tour, and where did that take you?
The book is literally step by step exactly where I went. So, we went, you know, to Tennessee, to Arkansas, Mississippi, Alabama, and, we literally got on a bus and, you know, trekked our way through these places. And so it was, like I said, it was a great experience. The gentleman who actually led the tour just passed away this past week. So it's been a little rough couple of days, even though I never really talked to him.
Yeah.
But throughout the writing of this book, he was such a guiding. So
All right. Well, it's a shame that he won't be able to hear this interview.
I know.
Dedication to him.
Yeah, Dr. Simon.
That's nice, Dr. Simon. Wow. Okay, so we're going to take a short break now.
Okay.
And when we come back, Janelle's going to tell us a little bit more. She's going to, you know, give us more of the background about the book and tell us what the story is about. So stay tuned. You're listening to episode 176 of Columbia Calling. It's Laura Brown filling in for Richard McCall. We'll be back in a few moments. Okay, we're back. This is Laura Brown filling in for Richard McCall on episode 176 of Columbia Calling. So thanks for joining us today. We're speaking to Janelle Gray, who's the author of Echoes of the Struggle, and we're bringing you today's interview from Quechua Cafe in the Zona G. Janelle's been telling us about her book. Janelle's from Texas in the U.S., and she lives in Colombia, lives in Bogota. And she's been telling us about Echoes of the Struggle, which is a story about the civil rights movement in the U.S. And it takes the 1960s American civil rights movement and places it among the 2014 spate of deaths of unarmed black men that happened over a period in the United States, in various different states. And so she kind of talks about the racial divide and what's been happening both in the past in the US and also in the present day.
Yes, very
yeah.
much.
Okay.
The intention of the book was to kind of place this juxtaposition of injustice in the US in terms of the past and the present. And for it to force these conversations that I think that we really should be having in our community. A lot of the times, especially with the topic of race,
right.
Because it's not a comfortable topic to talk about. And so especially with that particular topic, people tend to shy away from it. And for different reasons, and on both sides. And so I think the intention of the book is really just to draw the parallels of the history to the present, and how if we don't acknowledge the things of the past, we are definitely repeating.
Right.
And we don't see that it's. I mean, it's really easy when you have things like a country that is as rooted in slavery or
okay.
that has a past of discrimination, it's easy to say that those things are actually in the past.
Right.
But until we actually acknowledge all the work that was done, mm-hmm. all the things that happened, all the atrocities that actually happened,
right.
We don't actually notice that it's not really so far in the past.
Okay.
So that's the purpose.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so the book was kind of inspired by a tour that you went on where you followed the civil rights movement and key places
mm-hmm.
Of historical interest.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a bit more about the tour that you went on.
The tour was really interesting. The way it's written is not autobiographical. I actually went on the tour with my father.
Okay.
So it was a different story. I can probably tell you a completely different story. So it was really cool to go... with my daddy, because he is such a history person.
Okay.
And so it was nice to take the tour with him.
Right.
And he's also the person who has really pushed us to learn about where we come from.
Okay.
And so doing a genealogy on our family and knowing, you know, the history of our family,
that's interesting.
That was very important.
Well, what
to
did
him.
You find out? What Where did your family come from?
I actually still don't know that. He's going to kill me if he hears this. I actually haven't done that test, and I actually would like to do that test.
Okay.
I actually need to see if there's a place to get it done here, but I don't know. I don't know.
Maybe one of our listeners knows where you can get the genealogy test done
please.
In Bogota. So, yeah, please feel free to write in and tell us.
Yes, please. I would love to know exactly what the roots are. But it's more of what he... instilled us was like the stories of our family. It was important to sit, like my great grandmother, to sit at her feet and listen to her talk about her grandparents and these stories.
Right.
And so because of his dedication
yeah.
to our history and to history in general,
yeah.
it made the trip a little bit more interesting.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Okay. So where did you start off?
We started in Arkansas.
Okay.
I'm trying to remember, like, I'm actually sitting here trying to remember where we went and what order, but we started in Arkansas, and the reason I remember it so clearly
mm-hmm.
is my family is from Arkansas.
Ah, okay.
And so as I'm on this tour with Daddy, I'm walking around going, okay, yeah, I know this, because my father, he would take us and he would give us his own tour. Like,
okay.
he was not about the tours of the other people.
Right.
He was about giving us our own. And so we had been to Central High School.
Okay.
And we had walked, my older sister and I, had walked with him, you know, around Central High School. And he could
so
point to those
what's
things.
What's the significance of Central High School? Because a lot of our listeners
that's
probably
true.
Wouldn't know that history.
So Central High School was the school that was integrated in Arkansas. And it was a big deal.
It was the first integrated school in the
high
country?
High school.
Okay.
It was the, and it was
in
the largest.
Country or in Arkansas? The
no,
first,
in the country.
In, the first in the country. It was
mm-hmm.
the first, okay.
And
integrated
I hope
school.
I'm not lying, but yes. And really, you know, even if it... I'm trying to remember. I think it was the first one. But even if it wasn't, the difference about Central High School and what
mm-hmm.
made Central High School super important is that time in history was when journalism became a big part of everyday life.
Okay.
And so the reason that...
So
like
what
I said,
year are we talking, more or less? In the 60s?
Listen, yes. 50s? I was like, listen, yeah. don't make me sound crazy. But I don't actually remember all the years. But it was such a big deal, because that was when you had, like, on this corner, you had a group of journalists that are sitting on the corner that are watching all of these things happen. So it was able, with the pictures and the stories, they were able to bring that into the homes across America, across the U.S. And so they were able to, like, show what racism looks like. They were able to show that this is what it looks like when someone, you know, spits at a child. This is what it looks like when someone yells at a child. And so why hadn't been done before.
Why was journalism so important at that time? Was that because it had just started to become televised?
Yes. Okay. Television had just begun, like, being a part of people's homes.
Okay, right.
So you could find it in people's homes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, whereas before it would have just been printed.
Exactly.
Now you could actually have it like on television. Okay, so So this was a really important time for in Little Rock, Arkansas, at this high school, because it was the first place that was being integrated, or one of the first places, if not maybe the first high schools. And people were watching it at home on their television sets, which was something quite new. So you were telling us about how the journalists would gather on the corner.
Yeah, they would gather on the corner, and at the time there was only one telephone. That was, of course, when there weren't cell phones. Right. So there is one payphone that they would use to call back to their wherever their news station was, and kind of report back to their news station in terms of what was happening. And so that's where a lot of that happened. And so the difference between Little Rock and how everything happened was mostly because people saw it, people hear it, and it became something that was tangible to them.
More real.
Yeah, because it's really easy to talk about it, but when you see it and you see all these pictures, a lot of the pictures of when they were integrating and the lone student walking through this huge...
So what happened? Give us a little bit more background information on how the integration process worked. So they said that this is going to be the first high school that black and white kids alike could attend.
Correct.
And how did the people react to that?
Not very well. So I believe the name of the school was Dunbar. It was the colored school.
Okay.
The colored counterpart.
Right.
And they were about the same size in terms of students. But what made Central High School also very important is it was the most expensive. It was expensively built in the nation at the time.
Wow.
It's a huge school. It's breathtakingly gorgeous. Mm-hmm. But because of that, they put a lot of this money into it. And so what was happening is that there's an education disparity between people of color and white people at the time. And so they didn't have, for example, if they had like a chemistry lab or something, they didn't have those resources. Okay. Dunbar High School had subpar books. So they'd have the books that maybe Central High had years prior.
Okay.
And so what was happening is you had these students at Dunbar who wanted desperately to be educated, be well educated, and wanted to have access to the same resources. It wasn't necessarily about going to school with white people.
Right.
It was about having access to those resources.
To the resources, and to the standard of education.
Exactly.
I guess, as well.
Exactly. And so from what I understand and the research that I found, they put out kind of like some feelers to the black community.
Right.
And I think they got like 20 students who said yes. Okay. Out of all of those students, they got 20, because it's dangerous.
Right.
It was dangerous. Yeah. Their parents would lose their job. Their parents could be, you know, harassed. The students could be harassed. And so it got whittled down because the other thing was, in order for them to go to school, they couldn't participate in any extracurricular activities.
Wow.
So for those people who played, you know, high school ball or something like that, they weren't allowed to work on whatever their newspaper was.
Okay.
They weren't allowed to have that.
So they would only be allowed to study. They
That's
were only
it.
There for the classes.
That's it.
Wow.
And so a lot of students decided not to because they either, A, didn't want to give that up, or B, they were afraid. Okay. And so it ended up getting whittled down to nine.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So was this kind of the protests that happened around the integration of the school, was that kind of the start of the civil rights movement?
I would say no. I would say no. I think, so for me, and this has always been my story, Emmett Till, the death of Emmett Till, which has recently, the story has recently been said to be false. Emmett Till was a young boy, early teen, who came to, he actually came down south to Money, Mississippi, to visit family there. And he's actually from Chicago. Okay. And Chicago was different. I mean, discrimination looked different, you know, further up north than it did in the south. And so it was a little different. And he went to visit his family. And the story is he whistled at a white woman.
Okay.
Or maybe said something like, "I'll see you later, baby." Okay. Or something. The story varies.
Right.
And he was with his cousins and friends who knew how the South worked.
Right.
And were like, oh my God, they were really scared.
Yeah.
And it turns out that the, I think, husband and brother-in-law of the woman that he supposedly whistled at came to the home where he was staying, dragged him out of the home, killed him. Not only did they kill him, but they mutilated his body, they shot him, they cut off his ear, they... it was terrible. It was so terrible that even his mother did not recognize him. The only way that she recognized him was a ring that he had been wearing that his father had given him years before. And so that, to me, is the beginning of the civil rights movement. That, to me, is, as I describe it, or as actually another woman described it to us, is the Pearl Harbor of the civil rights movement in the U.S.
Okay.
And to be fair, there are many. There are very many Pearl Harbors.
Yeah, I guess that's very true. I guess, you know, like there were various points where it all started.
And and it could, your Pearl Harbor could be different. You know what I mean? Exactly. Like, I think that's the thing, is there are so many things
things bubbling away, waiting to explode.
Mm-hmm. And it touches everybody differently.
Yes, exactly.
So,
That's true. That's right. Okay, and so what about, so you're on this tour, you started off in Little Rock, Arkansas. What other key places did you visit?
We went to a lot of places, but we went to, of course, where...
kind of
where
the standout ones for you?
You have, of course, Tennessee, and you have, of course, like the Montgomery... We went to Montgomery, where the bus boycott. We talked about the Freedom Riders, where they integrated the interstate bus travel. But for me, I think the standout, I wrote it a little differently in the book, but the standout was the Edmund Pettus Bridge.
Edmund Pettus Bridge, and
yes,
where
in
was
Selma.
That, and what was that? Ah, in Selma.
Mm-hmm. And so for me, it was, you've seen the movie, or not, people have seen the movie, right, Selma, so you see this movie, and it kind of does show you a little bit.
Selma was, tell us again, for those who don't remember, like myself.
Okay. the movie?
Yeah.
So the movie is about...
It's more about Martin Luther King's wife, isn't it? Is that right?
No, actually, well, you know what? Now that I think about it, in terms of the movie, like, my head is so full of actually Selma, Alabama, what happened on the bridge. So you have the Selma to Montgomery March, is what it is.
Right.
And so you have what we call Bloody Sunday, Turnaround Tuesday, and then the Selma to Montgomery March. The intention of the march was anti-police brutality, which is why I think it stood out so much to me, you know, in terms of what we have going on here. So it originally started with the murder of a man there.
Okay.
And what they actually wanted to do was to take his body and leave it on the footsteps of the Capitol building and say to signify that the establishment is killing us. And so some kind of way that
It turned, and it changed to in March. Well, what happened is they crossed over. They met at a church, like the movement usually does. It meets and starts at a church, and they crossed over Edmund Pettus Bridge.
Okay.
And as they were crossing over Edmund Pettus Bridge, they were met with a wall of police officers.
Yes, I remember that scene in the movie.
Yes. Yeah. And what they did not know is there were police officers who had actually been brought in and deputized that weren't even a part of the city. Wow. So they had actually asked for other people to come and surround them. So they had way more than normal.
Right.
And they were surrounded, and then all the violence erupted.
Wow.
So for me, that was a standout, mostly because I literally walked across the bridge.
Oh, wow.
And so it was really hard to walk across that bridge and not get teary-eyed.
Right,
you know?
Exactly. Just thinking of everything that had happened there.
Exactly. Exactly. It's definitely, it's like you're walking amongst this spirit.
Yeah.
And so for me, I think that that was a standout moment. There were many.
Many, I'm sure.
But that one was a big one for me.
And so then where did you get the idea to kind of bring it into the modern day, like what's happening now in the U.S.?
Because originally, the journal pieces that are in the book are actually my journal. They're my actual journal that I wrote while I was on the tour.
Okay.
And so people were asking, they were saying, they followed me as I took the journey.
Right.
And they said, you should really publish this. This is really interesting. And I thought 12 is... just these 12 journal entries is not really enough.
Okay.
And I started thinking, I don't think this really does it justice, because I'm talking about these these few key moments in history.
Okay.
But I'm not, sometimes unless you draw the parallel, they can't actually make the connection.
Right.
Sometimes you have to draw the parallel for people.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so for me, that's what it came down to. And I wanted to make sure that I told more of the stories and gave more depth to what was happening.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, nice.
Yeah.
And was there anything, so you talk about the spate of unarmed black men being killed on the streets in the US.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any specific one that kind of triggered your pushed you in that direction?
No. I think it's most certainly not a particular one. I think it's the quantity that keeps triggering me.
Right.
It's not one name is not any more important. I would definitely say, of course, if you look at Trayvon Martin, I would definitely say that Trayvon Martin was our Emmett Till. I think he was our generation Emmett Till.
Right.
Because there were many before him.
Okay.
There have been many after him.
Right.
But for some reason, everybody got on one accord for that one.
Right.
And then from that moment, you see the movement
Because it was something that had been happening.
Yes.
And kind of continues to happen.
Yes.
But that was when... And I remember, it was around the world. We were reading the news about him in South Africa.
Mm.
And
which I think is really interesting.
Mm.
I think it's really interesting to know that in South Africa, these names, these names are making it to South Africa.
Exactly.
These Trayvon Martins, these Tamir Rice's, these Philando Castiles, Alton Sterling. These names continue to cross.
Right.
And I think that's very interesting.
Yeah, that's true. There have been so many, so many Trayvon Martins, like you say,
mm-hmm.
and the world only really started to pay notice when after his death.
Mm-hmm.
And the backlash that came after that. So tell us a little bit, how do you feel living in Colombia? How do you feel do you feel like the racism in Colombia is similar to in the US? Or, I shouldn't really put the term racism on it, but let's say race relations.
I can only talk about my experiences.
Yeah.
I definitely think that it exists. Despite the fact that many people will tell me it doesn't.
Okay.
I think that that's the first thing, which I think actually bothers me in the U.S. too.
Okay, that people
please
tell you
don't
that
tell me it doesn't exist.
It's all in the past.
Right.
Slavery ended centuries ago.
Right. And so that's not really, you can't tell me my experience,
right.
I think is my thing. So I think despite the fact that people will tell me it doesn't exist here.
Yeah.
It does. And so my first experience was my first week here.
Okay. And what happened then?
I was staying at a hostel. I hadn't found an apartment yet. I was staying at a hostel. They decided they wanted to go to Teatron. And I went with other foreigners, not necessarily from the U.S., but
okay.
just different places. And they all were let in for a certain amount. And then when it got to me, the first thing was, no, I'm sorry, it's a private party. You can't come in.
Wow.
And I was like, no, but my friends just went in. They were like, no, that's different. They were different. It's a private party. And I said, no, it's not. We're staying together.
Yeah.
And then they were like, oh, okay. Then your price is, and then they charged me $20,000
more. They charged you $20,000
more? They charged me $20,000 more. And so I was like, yeah, I'm not doing that, because they just paid something completely different.
Wow.
And it took them turning around and saying, no, she's with us. Yes.
Your friends had to come back.
They had to come back and say, she's with us.
Wow.
Or I had a student who made a comment about black people by saying, like, oh, well, I don't want to go to Jamaica. There are too many black people. And I'm standing there, like, we're in class, and I'm looking at my skin, like, did I change? Like, did something happen? Did I all of a sudden become non-black? Like, what happened? Did you forget? And he was like, oh, no, not like you. Like,
I'm not like you.
Right. Not like you, the bad kind. So I'm like, oh, so I'm the good kind of black person. He was like, yeah, you know, like the bad kind that do the drugs and have dreads.
Okay.
And so I'm showing him a picture, and he was like, yeah, like that. And I'm like, that's my mother. That picture that I just showed you with a woman that has dreads, that's my mother.
Wow.
So, you know, so okay. that exists.
Yeah.
It exists here. And so I think what irritates me across, no matter what it is
okay.
don't tell me it doesn't exist.
Okay.
Just because you haven't seen it
right.
doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And it comes in like little bitty conversations. Like that's
right.
just a little bitty piece,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, it exists.
It
does definitely exist here.
What about the situation with immigrants in the US at the moment, like with this whole, you know, clampdown on immigration?
I honestly can't even respond to it without rolling my eyes. I try. I actually try.
How do you feel as a person from the US who's living outside of the country and who has, you know, like to a large extent been welcomed in another country?
Yeah.
To kind of see that the same is not necessarily true for people.
You know, like I said, it bothers me.
Yeah.
But I think what bothers me more is that those same people
mm-hmm.
are the people who supported me when I moved. Like, for me,
okay.
it's the hypocrisy behind it.
Okay.
You know, I don't like it.
Right.
Period. But the extra sting to me is that
yeah.
hypocrisy behind it, where it's like, oh, go out, have this lovely adventure. Like, it's totally okay
yeah.
for you, the Texas girl, to go out and have this great adventure and
right.
live in these other countries. And
yeah.
and but if they come here, it's different.
Right.
It's a completely
yeah.
different ballgame.
Yeah.
So I watched when all of that happened.
Yeah.
I had many, many friends in Dallas who were at the Dallas-Fort Worth airport.
Oh wow! Okay.
Who were there protesting?
Who were protesting.
Yes,
well,
and
protesting
so it was
the ban.
It was nice to actually feel like, okay, my city is doing, you know, it, like my friends, the people in, you know, that are my friends are out there doing that. You know, they're supporting essentially rights for everyone.
Right.
They're actually pointing out the hypocrisy.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, I mean, I think that we can just hope that that there are more good people in the world than there are bad.
Yes.
And I don't think that, you know, immigration is going to stop to any country. I think, you know, I hope that they can keep opening borders and opening arms and welcoming people. Because, I mean, you know, I say from my own experience and probably, you know, you too, apart from a couple of bad incidents,
mm-hmm.
that we are treated very well as
yes.
foreigners here in Colombia.
Yes.
And, you know,
agreed.
I think that we're very fortunate, and I hope that people can find the same if they go to our countries.
Yes.
You know? I don't know how people are treated. It would be interesting to hear what people's experiences of moving to South Africa. I'd say that they probably would be quite welcomed, but, you know, who really knows?
Right. Well, I have a friend that's there now. So,
well,
yeah.
There you
so
go,
it, I'm assuming it's pretty welcoming because
yeah.
he's there now.
Right.
But yeah, I definitely, that's the hope. Yeah. That's the hope, is that people realize that we really are stronger together. It's
definitely,
we improve each other.
Exactly. So. Exactly. Oh, this is very true. Well, thanks so much, Janelle. It's been really interesting talking to you. I'm about halfway through the book and I'm really enjoying it. If anybody would like to get a copy, do you have that information? Can you tell us now, or we'll put it on the website?
Put it on the website, but right now, if it's somebody in Colombia, they can reach out to me through the website, and I have a few books left.
You still have a few books left.
I have a few books left here.
That's really nice. So, and also, do you have any other reading or watching, viewing that you can recommend that talks about this whole kind of civil rights movement and everything that we've been talking about here?
You know what? There is a long list, which I actually, if you'd like, I could probably present it or give it to you so you could put it on the website. But there is a long list as well. But the ones that stand out are like Neshoba, The Price of Freedom, The Four Little Girls. Those are great documentaries that I've been watching, and really any Eyes on the Prize. It's a little old, but it's got the same information, and it's narrated by Julian Bond.
That's great. So there'll be a link on the site, on Columbia Calling, to your blog, so people can contact you through that. Yeah, if they want to get the book or get any more information.
Any more information? Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for talking to us. We're talking to Janelle Gray, author of Echoes of the Struggle. And this is episode 176 of Columbia Calling. I'm Laura Brown, filling in for Richard McCall. Thanks so much.
America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. By honoring your career calling, you impact your family, your friends, and your community. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.